2:32 a.m. and I call the meeting of the complaint screening committee of the Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. Ms. Michelson, roll call, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Seidman?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Okay, we have quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Approval of minutes. I'm recused, so Dr. Stewart or Dr. Seidman, do you want to carry this through?
I move that we adopt the minutes from the previous January 22nd, 2025 regular session and executive session minutes.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Okay, let's go into our case discussion and decision. And as some of you know, there are important preliminaries to keep in mind. Before discussing the cases scheduled for review, I'll be sharing, some of the important information related to those. So the CSC, pursuant to the statute section 32-2081, subsection H, may dismiss the complaints appearing on this agenda or refer them to the full board for consideration and action. Complaints dismissed by the committee shall not be disclosed in response to a telephone inquiry or placed on the board's website, according to ARS section 32-2081, subsection H1. Upon a vote of a majority of the quorum, the committee may go into executive session on any item on the agenda, according to section 38-431.03, subsection A2, to receive confidential records, or subsection A3, to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney, Ms. Jean Galvin. Please keep in mind that the chair reserves the right to change the order of the items listed on the agenda, based upon the parties who are present or absent. Please use initials only for patients, children, and the complainant. Also, do not state the specific diagnosis in open session. Please just say, quote unquote, the diagnosis. Please also keep in mind that the content of many records involved in these complaints is confidential and the content should not be discussed in a public meeting. The committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential records. A person or a representative of a person who has filed a complaint and is present at today's meeting may make a brief statement of up to 5 minutes, when prompted by the chair. Additionally, the licensee or the respondent who is the subject of the complaint will also have the opportunity to make a brief 5-minute statement when prompted by the chair. The committee may also have questions for the complainant or respondent after their statements are made. Please note that only individuals directly involved in the complaint, which are the complainant and the respondent, may address the committee and make a statement. If the committee wishes to hear from any other party, it will make this request during the case review. For everyone in attendance, please ensure that your audio remains on mute. When prompted by the committee to speak, the complainant, the respondent, and their legal representatives may unmute themselves at that time. Individuals in attendance who speak out without committee approval will be warned twice by the chair not to interrupt. If the interruption continues after the second warning, the individual will be removed from the Zoom meeting and not permitted to re-enter. So with those things in mind, let's go to the first complaint on the agenda 4A, which is case number 25-20 against Adam Frose. Dr. Stewart, will you please provide us an overview?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to. Dr. Frose has his PhD from the University of Memphis in 2018. He became licensed in Arizona in 2020. His license expires in July of 25. The complainant, AK, is a United States Air Force veteran and had applied for disability. A psychological assessment was ordered. Dr. Frosch conducted that evaluation and then filled out a disability benefits questionnaire, a DBQ. AK states that the gist of it is that Dr. Frosch intentionally steered the his report away from issues that the complainant had brought up. There's a cultural social diagnosis, but it's not a medical diagnosis, nor does the VA recognize this as a diagnosis that was raised by the complainant, AK, as being the cause of his admitted VA diagnosis, and that as a result of this social cultural diagnosis and his experiences, that it exacerbated this physical diagnosis that he has at the VA. And so the complainant wishes the board to intervene and to punish, for lack of better wording, punish Dr. Frosch for an intentional misleading of his report. I've read Dr. Frosch's report and would be happy to comment on that later on as well. So that's my, in a nutshell, review of the complaint by AK.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Let's see if AK is present. I don't see AK in our list. Okay, then I see Dr. Frosch and your attorney, Dr. Akins. Thank you both for being here. So now would be the time to make a statement, and then I'm sure we'll have questions. You're muted, Dr. Akins.
Now I'm there. Are you hearing that?
Yes.
Yes.
Very good. Hello, I'm Farron Akins. I'm counsel for your licensee, and I'll let Dr. Frosch introduce himself. I'll just say up front that we feel that the response that we've submitted covers all of the pertinent issues that are noted in the complaint. So we have nothing further to add by way of an opening statement at this point, but we're certainly happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Dr. Frosch?
Hello. I'm Dr. Adam Froese. I agree with my attorney here in terms of I'm happy to answer any questions anyone has, but yeah, in terms of no further comments at this time.
Dr. Stewart, Dr. Seidman, questions?
I'd be happy to start off. Dr. Froese, I've read your report. I've read your response to the complaint leveled by AK. How many evaluations do you think you've done in this genre, either direct disability for VA benefits or disability for other cases, like Social Security, for instance?
Yeah, I don't have an exact number, but I think a good estimate would be far exceeding 2,500, probably closer to 3,500 at this point, yeah.
Excellent. Thank you. Has there been a complaint previously that you have deliberately misled the reader and that you have deliberately steered your report and its conclusion by deliberately leaving out information?
No.
Because there's a social cultural diagnosis involved here, which I think I could say, but I still don't see our associate attorney general on board, so I'll hold off.
I am here, Dr. Stewart, but I would refrain from disclosing any diagnosis on the record.
Even something that's not a medical diagnosis. It's not in the DSM. The VA does not have that as a diagnosis for disability.
Does Dr. Frosch, are you aware of the diagnosis to which Dr. Stewart is referring?
Not necessarily. I'm sorry, Dr. Stewart. Are you saying the diagnoses that were rendered by myself,
no,
or are you talking
no,
about a different?
No, sir. It was one that AK thought should have been provided that he suffered from, is victimized in association with this social cultural diagnosis, and that you failed to mention that in the proportion that he thought it should be mentioned in your report. I don't know if that clears things or makes it more muddy for you.
Well, yeah, I'm not specifically familiar with exactly. Okay. I'm not sure exactly what diagnosis you're speaking to.
Okay.
Dr. Stewart, in that case, I mean, we have the patient confidentiality. AK is not here. We haven't disclosed his name. If you want to mention the diagnosis and, you know, explore that a little bit further with Dr. Foes, that's fine.
Okay. So I can mention the social. Okay. Racism, repeated racism. Again, it's not anywhere in the VA diagnostic protocol as being a diagnosis for which disability would be given. Is that your understanding as well?
Yes, I believe so. As far as I know, yes.
Okay.
And for the benefit of committee members, the diagnosis is listed on page 11 of our PDF document.
And so when you, did you deliberately not mention this man's complaints of suffering, being victimized by racism? Did you deliberately steer your report away from any such discussion?
No, I did not. In the formal report, it was actually discussed and stated multiple times in terms of what the gentleman spoke to me about.
Yeah. But it's not a diagnosis. It's not a VA diagnosis. So there'd be no reason. You couldn't list it as a diagnosis anywhere, could you?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. I have no further questions, and I would certainly, if the chair would entertain a motion, I'll make a motion.
Let's see if Dr. Seidman has any questions. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. Good morning, Dr. Froese. In reflecting back on this case, is there anything you would have done differently?
Good morning. No, I don't think I would have done anything differently.
Okay, thank you. And I just want to make a quick comment for the general public. So I think Dr. Stewart brought up a really good point, and I think what he's alluding to is a Z code that would be in the DSM, which is not related to disability, but could be a focus of clinical attention for psychologist or wherever the treating provider is in the future. So thank you for bringing that up, Dr. Stewart.
Yes. Dr. Froese, were you ever in a position to render clinical treatment for AK?
As in like a therapist role? No.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And just one question for the record. So I see there was a North Carolina Psychology Board a complaint, and North Carolina's board decided to take no action. Is that correct, Dr. Froese?
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar
or,
with.
Or sorry, I just see that there has been no action on your record in the North Carolina from the North Carolina. I apologize for the confusion.
Okay. Yeah. No.
Okay.
Got you excited there for a moment, huh, Dr. Froese?
Yes, definitely.
Dr. Seidman.
If the chair would be willing to entertain a motion, I'd like to make a motion.
Sure.
I'd like to make a motion to dismiss this case. There's no unprofessional conduct, no violation of ethics code. That's my motion.
Second.
There is a motion and a second. Discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
None opposed, the motion carries. Good luck, Dr. Frost.
Thank you, board members. We appreciate your good work this morning.
Thank you.
Okay, 4B is complaint number 25-17 against Bethany Young, who holds an authorization with SciPact, the interjurisdictional compact for psychologists. And I am the lead, so I'll attempt to provide us quick a summary as Dr. Stewart managed. Dr. Young is has been licensed in Maryland since 2021 and has a SciPact authorization starting in August of 2024. And this is one of those emotional support animal cases that this committee and the full board has seen in recent months. So Dr. Young practices telepsychology in Arizona. Her home state for SciPact purposes is Maryland. The complainant here is DL, who was the same complainant in some of the previous cases related to emotional support animals. And the culprit website is the same website that we have seen before, American Service Pets, operated by Greater Guide, Inc. So this complaint arose because DL saw that Dr. Young had issued a emotional support animal letter to somebody, and that letter is in our record. The letterhead shows a Scottsdale address, and the letter authorized a beagle as the ESA. Dr. Young admits that this letter was issued in her name, I'll conclude my summary there, but I need to elicit some responses from Dr. Young to some of the questions I have on my mind. So before I do that, I don't see DL present. Can you confirm, Ms. Michelson?
Mr. Chair, I don't see him present. He did not respond to my email with a meeting notice.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so Dr. Young, I see you're present, and I believe you're represented by Mr.
Randall Nice.
Thank you,
Mr. Both in snow.
Thank you. Now would be the time to make a statement, and we'll have questions.
Sure. Thank you. I'll start. Good morning. My name is Randall Nice, and it's an honor to represent Dr. Bethany Young as counsel in this matter. No doubt the committee has already reviewed the complaint, our response, and the investigative file, so I won't duplicate those efforts. I would, however, like to ensure the board views this matter through the appropriate lens. The complaint in this matter was not filed by a legitimate patient of Dr. Young, nor was it filed by someone who suffered from some sort of professional malpractice. Rather, it was filed by a company in an effort to undermine its competition. In short, Dr. Young was working as a secondary employment for an organization that assisted people in obtaining ESA letters that allowed them to keep emotional support animals in their rental units and other such reasons. The complainant in this matter works for a similar ESA company that is a direct competitor to the company for which Dr. Young worked. Although the complaint comes from an organization claiming to combat fraud, Exhibit A to our response highlights the industry benefactor of this organization is a rival company providing ESA letters. With that in mind, I would urge the board not to allow its important role as a professional regulator to be co-opted for a business dispute. There are civil remedies that the complainant can pursue if they truly feel they've been wronged by another company's business practice. I'd also like to take this opportunity to urge the committee to disregard the legal analysis provided by the complaint. The complainant included a California case as wholly irrelevant to the matter at hand and contains allegations not alleged against Dr. Young, including allegations of unlicensed practice, misrepresenting a license, false advertising, and failure to cooperate with an investigation. None of those issues are at hand today. Additionally, the complainant, The complaint, which appears to be a form letter, contains allegations unsupported by facts. For example, the complaint alleges Dr. Young claimed to be treating the recipient and that she stated the recipient was eligible for an ESA under state and federal law. These statements are found nowhere in the letter Dr. Young issued. Dr. Young issued this letter pursuant to a good faith analysis of the facts with which she was presented. Dr. Young, who will make a statement shortly, is a major in the Air Force where she provides critical assistance to the service members protecting our nation. She has no prior complaints and an excellent reputation. Dr. Young takes this matter seriously, and since a complaint has been filed, she's undertook 17.5 hours of relevant continuing education to ensure she is appropriately versed in her professional and legal obligations as a provider. Accordingly, we would respectfully request that the committee dismiss the complaint and all allow Dr. Young to make her statement.
Dr. Young.
First of all, thank you all for your time today. I'm not going to take up too much time and reiterate everything that I had said in my response. But just wanted to really just emphasize that, you know, any evaluation I do is completed in good faith. And my intent has always been to maintain compliance. However, I recognize I'm not perfect. There's always room for growth. And I remain committed to upholding the highest ethical standards in my practice. I wanted to acknowledge the accusation and show that I had taken the accusation under serious consideration and reassure the board that I've taken the time to reflect on everything, on my best course of action moving forward. I'm a newer psychologist, so I'm in that crucial phase of building my foundation in my ethical practice and just being committed to that continuous growth. That's why I wanted to complete those 17 and a half hours of continuing education courses. And those were dedicated to various topics about writing those ESA letters, as well as telehealth in general, to ensure that I enhance my knowledge and skills in this forever evolving area of practice. And yeah, just really wanted to thank you all again for your time and happy to answer any further questions.
Thank you. Okay, so Dr. Young, I'm looking at the letter, which is at page 16 of our PDF. It says there's emotional distress. The letter says emotional distress as defined by DSM-5. Could you speak to what sort of analysis or what sort of methodology do you follow as a psychologist in reaching this diagnosis?
Yes. So without sharing any specific diagnosis that I had given this false client, so reviewing their questions that they had answered, it goes over different signs and symptoms of varying disorders. So taking those questions and mapping them onto specific criteria from the DSM. So some examples would be relevant DSM criteria. So talking of depressed mood, loss of interest, loss of pleasure in activities, excessive anxiety, worrying about various domains. Some of the questions asked about if they've had identifiable stressors, which can map onto adjustment disorders. And so for this specific case, did you want me to go into this specific case or just my general?
No, just general, your way of doing things. Thank you.
Of course, yeah.
And the questions that you mentioned that you evaluate are also in our record. There are basically like 14 or 15 questions, yes?
I don't know the exact number, but I think it's around that number without having to look into my notes.
Yeah. And was there any sort of in-person consultation with the hypothetical patient or, you know, the person whose file you thought you were evaluating?
There was not.
Okay. How many of these ESA letters, in your knowledge, have you issued when you were contracted with Greater Guide?
With this specific company, I don't have an exact number, but I would guess, or I would estimate, based on I've been working with them since I believe 2002, across multiple states. So it would be about 2,000 across multiple states, that I had evaluated.
Okay. And are you currently contracting with them, or have you terminated that contract?
No, I terminated my contract with them, after I received this complaint.
And which, like, roughly month and year was the contract terminated by you?
What, I'm sorry, which month was it?
Yeah.
So I had originally had a conversation with my supervisor in September after I had received the complaint, and I'd asked them no longer to no longer send me any referrals, to stop services. However, later on, I realized that I never actually like formally resigned with them. So I sent an email, I believe it was in November of 2024, with my formal resignation, but I have not seen any referrals with them since September.
Thank you. So then you said you started with them in 2002?
2022. Sorry.
22. Okay, yeah,
Yes,
thank you. Because
yes.
I was going to ask, well, your license and yeah,
Yes, yes, yeah.
okay. Okay, that's all the questions I have for now, Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Chairman Diner. Good morning, Dr. Young.
Morning.
Could you share with us what your formal training is related to completing ESA letters?
Yes, so I have formal training in different assessment procedures that I received in graduate school, as well as my practice with the military. And then I also took some individual CEUs for emotional support animal letters, with the most recent of those being, I don't have the exact date here, but it was within that September to November timeframe. But I had taken a couple of CEUs before that. I don't have the dates on hand. I would have to go back and find those.
Sure. Thank you. And I'm wondering, in your formal training in graduate school and perhaps an internship and maybe postdoc, you were taught that the standard is typically to meet with a client and to be able to do like an MSE, to be able to identify, formal diagnoses and symptom severity and DTS and those kinds of things. And I'm wondering, when you were thinking about doing ESA letters, did you think about that kind of discrepancy between this idea of doing them all over the country and not the same protocol that you were trained in formally?
Looking back now, I wish I would have consulted more with peers to make sure that I'm reinforcing the best practices, and staying up to date on those evolving telehealth requirements. I know with my work with the military, I am very passionate about easing access to therapeutic services, because I see so many members that will come into our clinic, and just the stigma, especially with PTSD and other trauma related disorders. There is so much stigma related to that, and people will say like, oh, I wanted to come in years ago, but I never did. Or, access to care is, I think right now our clinics are months waiting lists. And so in my mind, as I was going through this process, I was really just wanting to prioritize that ease to access to care. But again, looking back on it now, just really wishing I would have consulted to make sure that I was in fact, reinforcing that best practice.
I appreciate those comments. And do you have a consulting support network now, in place for you for your future practice?
I do, yes. I have some old supervisors that I reach out to regularly for like military related things. But wanting to shift that mindset to realizing that, like, no, this isn't just something that I have to do for military. It can be for general practice as well as some peers that I've gone through graduate school with who are outside of the military, so I can have that comprehensive civilian and military peer and consultation network.
That's terrific. That's good to hear. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Mr. Denner. Dr. Young, thank you for being with us this morning. So the formal training that you have and the additional CEUs in assessing for emotional support animals, who sponsored those? Are those all APA approved credits?
I know for sure the, I'd have to, do you mind if I refer to my notes real quick? I want to make sure
please
I don't
do.
Give a
please
false.
Please do.
Okay. I know most of the most recent, the CEUs that I've taken were through PESI or PESI. I'm not sure how it's pronounced.
Yeah. Right. National, it's a national CEU provider, sure.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
How about the original training in how to do the emotional support animal assessments?
I honestly don't know off the top of my head. I don't want to say something false.
Okay.
I typically tend to look for things that are APA just so that I can get the official APA CEUs. But I can't, right. I'm not going to say 100% sure it was because I don't know for a fact.
Right. Sure. The letters that you have written for emotional support animals, have they all the letters been for active or former military?
They have not.
Have any of them been for active or former military?
I know I have never written one for active military because mm-hmm. there become some complications with the idea of somebody who's active military right. needing a service animal that gets into complications with fitness for duty and stuff like that. So I have never written one through my capacity for my full-time job in the military.
Okay. And how many letters do you think you've written in total?
Probably about that 2,000 mark.
So 800 a year for 3 years. So you signed on with them in 2022.
Yes.
22, 23, 24. So over that 3 year period, you've written 2,000 letters. So about 800 or so, 700 each.
I think it's about 2 years, Dr. Stewart.
2 years.
Yeah. She ended her contract with them in November of 2024.
So 2,000 letters in 2 years. Have you ever done an evaluation? Have you ever been contacted to do an evaluation and you've conducted the evaluation and the person and or animal combination did not qualify, in your thinking, for emotional support animal?
Yes. There have been some evaluations that I've done that they did not qualify.
So of the 2,000, what percentage or what number, if you any rough idea?
I would say maybe about 50. Again, just a rough estimate.
In APA, and Dr. Seidman will correct me where I'm in error, to do a new undertaking, did you have graduate school training in emotional support animals and their assessment?
Not to my knowledge. It was more in the basic assessment process, not right. specifically in emotional support.
Oh, okay. So 2,000 letters in 2 years. So that's 1,000 cases per year. So, and how much time do you spend? Do you just interview the doggy dad or kitty parent, or what do you see the animal at all, or no?
I do not know.
Let me circle back to my line of questioning that I may need Dr. Seidman's help with here. So in undertaking a new area, which would be the emotional support animal assessment area and the need for, and undertaking and doing that kind of work, APA requires a pretty good bit of personal research by the psychologist in these areas and how to do this unique, different type of evaluation. A 1,000 letters a year. How did you do that? I mean, you're a major in the Army, right? So, or Air Force.
Air Force.
Air Force. You're a major in the Air Force. So how did you do 1,000 letters a year?
So working through the service, when I began working for them, they just started sending referrals, and so completing that the referrals that were sent to me.
I have no further questions at this point, Mr. Dinar.
Thank you. Just a few follow-ups, Dr. Young. So when you're doing these evaluations based on the 13, 14, 15, whatever questions that were self-reported via the referrals you got from Greater Guide, were you at any point under the impression that you were simply doing an initial evaluation and somebody else within the Greater Guide contract would do the actual evaluation and render a diagnosis? Or were you aware that by authorizing some of these questionnaire participants to go to the next phase, you are actually issuing the emotional support animal letter?
I was aware that I was initiating the letter.
Okay. Dr. Seidman.
I'd like to circle back to Dr. Stewart's line of questioning, specifically related to new areas for psychologists to provide services in. And the ethics code is quite clear on that psychologists can do that. However, they need to make reasonable efforts to obtain the competence required by using relevant research, training, consultation, or study. And my concern here, and I think it's shared with other members of the committee, that competency wasn't established and maintained, for lack of a better word, ongoing in terms of seeking either formal supervision and or consultation from more experienced peers and or mentors. Hindsight's 2020, and unfortunately, or fortunately, in our profession, to protect the welfare of our clients, prospective application and thinking through problem solving is required. And I'd like you to talk a little bit more to that, Dr. Young, in retrospect.
No, I can't disagree at all. I, like you said, hindsight is 2020, or at least we like to think it is most of the time. I definitely would consult more, build that trusted peer group, former supervisors, whomever it may be, and reach out to other providers in the field who may be doing those ESA letters to make sure that I am upholding best practices.
Yeah, thank you for that. And while, you know, while I appreciate your comments earlier about making services more accessible to people who need them, and we're right on board with you on that. The ramifications of that is also to organizations and other people, not only the person that you're trying to get into services, and that's really the public, if you will, and that's what we're trying to highlight here.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. It's definitely something, taking those moments to reflect, and really trying to expand that knowledge and that way of thinking.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Dr. Stewart. You're muted, Dr. Stewart.
I'm so sorry. Dr. Young, so what training have you had? Because I didn't see this mentioned in the letter for this client. What training have you had, and what is your responsibility to assess the impact on the animal? So is there a veterinary certificate provided that the animal and this animal parent are in good stead, that they work together? Or I mean, what how did you assess the animal and whether what impact this might have on the animal?
I did not assess the animal.
How about the impact of the animal on the animal from a crowded dormitory setting? If the client is a student at university, a crowded dormitory, and the poor ESA animal is being subjected to multiple different new people every day or every week. So I didn't see that as a concern or an issue, or even that it had been considered at all in your letter of support for this ESA. Is that accurate? And what I'm saying, is that accurate?
I did not assess that information.
Okay, that's all my questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So now let's go into our discussion and deliberation on this. So I think what I'm hearing from today's dialogue with Dr. Young is it's a multidimensional issue in whenever any emotional support animal is authorized. You have to do a more detailed evaluation of all of the conditions, circumstances involved, and the greater guide model just doesn't have room for a psychologist to be able to do that effectively. In the past, I believe the board has expressed concern with this particular model of authorizing emotional support animals, and we have correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Galvin, but I think we have done non-disciplinary letters of concern for these sort of things. So I guess I'm leaning towards, as a matter of initial discussion, notifying Dr. Young that there is a concern under our statute, subsection G, engaging or offering to engage as a psychologist in activities not congruent with the psychologist's professional education, training, and experience. And I believe DD for ethical violations, but I'll need Dr. Seidman or Dr. Stewart to help me with the actual ethics code section. But I'll stop there and see what thoughts the other committee members have. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I don't think anything in Dr. Young's behavior is malevolent intent or any evil or intent or anything like that. I think it there is a need. I think she was approached by a company that does this, and given referrals by that company. Who people respond to an ad on the internet or something, make your peacock become an emotional support animal, and they want to take it on an airplane, for instance, as what we saw a few years ago. And so I think that I don't think the training's there. I would certainly lean toward a non-disciplinary tactic here. Mr. Chair, for sure. I certainly support that. And I defer to Dr. Seidman in terms of the specific ethics code.
Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. I would agree with my colleagues here, Mr. Diner and Dr. Stewart. I honestly believe Dr. Young's intentions were good. And as Dr. Young mentioned, providing accessibility to services is extremely important, especially nowadays, with the shortage of mental health providers throughout the country and the world. With that said, sometimes psychologists can make decisions based on their heart, which outweighs their brain, their thinking. And it's extremely important for us to reflect on that and be aware of it, and then seek those resources that we have available to us to make the best decisions for all parties involved. With that said, I would agree a non-disciplinary letter would be most appropriate. And just for the record, in terms of the ethical issues that we need to consider from the American Psychological Association, if I am accurate, standard 2.04 bases for scientific and professional judgments, standard 9.01 bases for assessments. Those are, and 9.06 interpreting assessment results. I think those are the three primary ones that I noted. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. So I'll make a motion to refer this case to the full board with a recommendation to issue a non-disciplinary letter of concern for subsection G and DD as it relates to the three ethics code sections. I'm sure Ms. Galvin was writing them down when Dr. Seidman was mentioning them. So that's my motion.
I second.
Second.
All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Thank you, Mr. Nice and Dr. Young, for being here.
Thank
Thank you
you.
all for your time.
Okay, 4C is case number 25-18 against Mark Harvinchek. And Dr. Seidman, will you please provide us an overview?
Yes, Mr. Diner, I'd be happy to. Dr. Harvancik has been licensed by the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners since 1993 and operates a private practice in Kingman, Arizona, where he's provided evaluations for the Arizona State Board of Nursing for approximately 17 years. In July of 2024, Dr. Harvancik conducted a psychological evaluation which had an anger management component for complainant JC as part of a nursing board investigation. Excuse me, related to JC's application for licensure as an RN, as the board found that JC failed to disclose a prior arrest history on the application. Dr. Harvancik's report and JC's application were reviewed by the Arizona State Board of Nursing at its July 18th, 2024 meeting, and the board determined that a consent agreement was indicated, which included probation and restrictions. JC signed that consent agreement on in September of 2024
and was issued their license on September 27th of 2024. The consent agreement findings included Dr. Harvancik's statements that during the evaluation, JC provided limited information and it wasn't possible to determine specific disorders. Dr. Harvancik opined that with the collateral information obtained and the statements that JC made during the evaluation, that JC was able to function safely in a nursing capacity, although it was not clear any other issues that may be impacting his professional functioning. On September 24th of 2024, JC submitted a complaint to this board against Dr. Harvancik, alleging that the report and the reports included on page 31 of the materials that we've read, that the report contained critical errors, including omission of relevant information and misrepresentation of fact, which JC asserted compromised the integrity of the assessment, and that these actions have resulted in emotional, financial, and professional hardship. In response, Dr. Harvancik believes that JC's evaluation was reasonable, appropriate, and met our ethical standards and Arizona statutes. Dr. Harvancik does not believe there are any errors, although Dr. Harvancik noted that there was a misunderstanding about one of the medications, and Dr. Harvancik incorrectly wrote the name of the medication into the report. Dr. Harvancik attempted in an email to address JC's concerns of errors and to explain the information he based his conclusions on, and that's included in our documents as well. And that's a summary of this particular complaint. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. So I think JC, the complainant, is present. I see you in our list. So now would be the time to unmute yourself and make a statement if you wish to do so.
So Dr. Harvancik is a danger to the public. He's dangerous because he's expected to be truthful in his reporting. If someone in his position is dishonest, society is at risk for being harmed. In this case, his dishonest and or biased reporting has harmed me. So today, I hope to speak not only for myself, but also for his past and present patients who may be currently enduring a similar experience with Dr. Harvancik and have been harmed. I hope to highlight some of his misconduct in an effort to protect future patients from harm. Unfortunately, I have too many discrepancies in this report to address them all in only 5 minutes. However, I'll do my best with what I have. In addition to knowingly reporting that I took a medication that I've never taken, which was reported in my initial complaint, Dr. Harvancik mischaracterized an exchange between he and I pertaining to me being questioned about substance use. On page 4 of his report, he begins by stating concerning substance use history, Mr. C. Me initially said that he didn't understand why he was being questioned about substance use. This is patently
Mr.
false.
Mr. JC, if we're going to discuss specifics of the report or questions relating to any medical issues, we can go into executive session, so we don't have to disclose it on the public record. It's up to you.
Okay. Well, I guess we can do that privately.
Okay, I'll make a motion to go into executive session to discuss personal health information.
Second.
All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed, the motion carries. And we'll invite, Ms. Pakkanen. 39 a.m., still on case 4C. So now would be the time for committee members to ask JC any questions that are appropriate for open meeting, and then we'll go to Ms. Carvis. JC, yes, you have your hand up.
I mean, a lot of my issue was the fact that I had given Dr. Harvancic a lot of self-reported information, and for whatever reason, it was like manipulated or my story was like hijacked into something else. And I just think that's like wrong. You know, if, especially if it says in the report, like, this is what I said, or this is what I admitted to, or this is what I am, the information I'm giving to him, and it's, the story is spun in a way that I did not say. So, I mean, it's not necessarily, PHI, but it's just like throughout this this report, it's a lot of just this spin to what I did say, where it's like I did not say that though. If that makes sense, I don't know if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah. Thank you, JC. Any questions for JC? Okay, then let's go to Ms. Carvis and Dr. Harvancic. Now would be the time to make your statement.
Yes. Good morning, Dr. Diner, members of the board. We appreciate the opportunity to be heard this morning on these issues. I know that the board has reviewed all of the materials, so I'll keep my comments brief. Once I am done, Dr. Harvancic is happy to answer any questions that anyone may have. I think it's important for the board to keep in mind a couple of things here. That the reason for the referral for the evaluation in the first place was lack of disclosure of prior arrest history by JC on his application to the nursing board. So there was already a lack of forthcomingness in terms of sharing of information. When he reached out to Dr. Harvancic to schedule the evaluation, he was aware that this was not the typical private and confidential evaluation that you would receive if you were seeking personal care and treatment from a psychologist, but rather that this evaluation would be utilized and shared with the Arizona Nursing Board. The evaluation itself took an extremely long time, in part because of not being willing to share information, and also the completion of the MMPI took an extremely long time, which in and of itself also suggests that there was intent to not share information. When the report was provided to the nursing board, that was also provided to JC. When JC expressed questions to Dr. Harvancic about the content of the report or questions, he did address those. Dr. Harvancic acknowledged that there was an error in terms of one of the medications, and he readily acknowledged that. And those are sound alike drugs, as we say in the pharmacy terms. So I think that was a simple and honest mistake, certainly not one that contributed to the ultimate outcome with the nursing board. It's important for the board to be mindful of the fact that, again, the information that Dr. Harvancic provided to the nursing board was just a piece of the puzzle that the nursing board had when making a decision as to what was the appropriate outcome with respect to JC's application for licensure in the state of Arizona. Ultimately, he was offered a consent agreement by the nursing board that had a term of probation and terms along with that, including some specific terms that we discussed in an executive session. That was up to him to accept or reject. I understand that JC is frustrated that he started his licensure here in Arizona on probation, but that is not directly related to Dr. Harvancic's report or his comments. Dr. Harvancic has completed numerous evaluations for the nursing board. He's completed over 100. In his career, he's completed over 3,000. This is something that he does quite frequently. He did so reasonably and appropriately in this instance. And again, notwithstanding JC's frustration with the process was handled appropriately. And Dr. Harvancik completed his report based on the testing that JC completed, the interview, and also the significant amount of collateral information that he was provided by the nursing board. And we believe that as such, this matter is appropriate to be recommended to the full board for dismissal. Dr. Harvancik is here and happy to answer any questions that you have, but we appreciate the opportunity to be heard. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carvis. Questions for Dr. Harvancik at this point? So I have a question, Dr. Harvancik.
Certainly.
Were you given an opportunity to correct the report?
I never received a request from the nursing board to offer a corrected report. I didn't feel that the issue of the mispronunciation of the medication, especially considering that JC indicated that that medication was prescribed many years ago, I didn't think that that warranted a correction, that it really wouldn't be an issue. I mean, the issue of whether he was taking Prilosec or Abilify.
I'm sorry, you can't state the medications.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. New to this.
Okay, but I got the gist of your answer. Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. Good morning, Dr. Harvancik.
Good morning.
To piggyback on that question, did you ever attempt to notify the board of the mistake once you realized it? Beyond changing your report, notifying them of the mistake, because ultimately it's the board's decision what happens to JC.
I considered that. I also considered that the difficulty that I had in interviewing JC, the hesitancy to answer various questions, the issue of substance use questions has already been brought up. It was very difficult to question him and get him to elaborate on his answers. He also appeared to be quite impatient in completing the evaluation process. I didn't feel that medication issue was a concern to be addressed.
Even though you realized it wasn't the right, once you realized it wasn't the right medication.
I wasn't sure about whether that was actually accurate. He subsequently brought that to my attention, though there were also various discrepancies between the complaints that he raised and the information that he provided during the evaluation process. I found it very difficult to really assess the credibility of virtually any of his responses.
Sure.
There seemed to be a pattern there of not just hesitancy, but discrepancies in the information he was providing, and then certainly with the complaints that he submitted.
Having done a number of fitness for duty evaluations myself for regulatory boards, it's expected that examinees will be a bit reluctant because they have a lot to on the table. And while that's the case, I heard what you said. But once you realize that the medication error occurred and you sent him an email and you guys had an email interchange that you admittedly made an error, you never attempted to just notify the board of that mistake.
I don't believe I did.
Okay.
I continued to be suspicious, though, at that point that, I mean, is he telling me the right story this time or not? So I guess the thing to do would have been to say, well, I'm still suspicious of what the honest answer is. But now he's telling me it was Abilify when I had thought
just,
he had said.
Sorry, no medications,
please. Doctor. just being cautious not to discuss the medical condition.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
That's okay. And also, just briefly, I would like to add that obviously the nursing board presumably had access to JC's records and/or pharmacy records and would have known that information. Obviously, a better practice would be if there was a realization or the patient reported an error in the future. That's certainly something that Dr. Harvancic could consider just informing the board. I'm not sure which is correct, but it has been pointed out to me that this was an error. Presumably, JC also pointed out that information, his believed discrepancy to the nursing board as well. But I agree that a better practice would have been to at least submit the information to the investigator, even if not in an updated or formal report, and he'll be mindful of such issues in the future.
Well, I would also mention that I have, as a result of completing somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 evaluations, during that time, there's been rare occasions where I have, in fact, done that. In this case, though, again, I found it very difficult to find much of what JC said as being credible. And this was another example. He said that it was one medication versus another, and I chalked that up to a mispronunciation, and I could not verify that one way or the other, so I didn't pursue it with the board, the nursing board.
Thank you. And for the record, the provisional diagnoses reflect that uncertainty of the information that was provided.
Correct. Very definitely.
Okay. I have another just quick kind of question, and it may be relevant or not, but for your practice, Dr. Harvancic, I noticed that you're using some outdated editions of the objective measures that you're using for the fitness for duty eval. You're using the MCMI-3 and the MMPI-2. And I'm curious about that. There are some newer editions out.
Because of the length of time that I've been using those, because the inventories continue to be published, and I believe as a result of that, they continue to meet Daubert. I also testify in court quite often. I've testified now 99 times, and I'm well aware of the issues regarding the admissibility of evidence. And I would also cite the standards for educational and psychological testing that indicate that just because an inventory is old doesn't mean it's outdated. The test publishers have a responsibility of making sure that the product that they are continuing to publish that it does continue to be a valid and reliable instrument. So a combination of that and my experience in using those, I felt that it was appropriate to continue using those.
Yeah. I appreciate those comments. Just a suggestion, the newer editions have more up-to-date normative samples, and that might be just something to look at in the future. That's all. Thank you.
Yeah, I've actually looked at the MCMI-4, which I know was published in 2015. I guess one could even argue that maybe some of their norms are outdated. But given that the publishers are responsible for making sure that the norms are updated as needed, I continued to find that the two that I'm using, the MCMI-3 and the MMPI-2, would continue to be valid and acceptable inventories to use.
Any further questions? Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Dinar. Dr. Hrvancic, may I, if you have your evaluation report in front of you, may I direct you to your page 10 of that report?
Dr. Stewart, if we're going to speak directly about the evaluation and the report, it may be best to go into executive session.
I don't have to have him read the report, just a summary statement. It's not a diagnosis or anything else.
Okay.
It's just a note to the board.
Okay.
Did you assess and recommend that JC could operate safely as a nurse?
I indicated that he was able to function safely in a nursing capacity.
Okay, thank you.
That's all. Certainly.
Okay, so that concludes our questioning of, I'm sorry, JC, now is not the time. So we'll go into our discussions. Dr. Seidman, since you're the lead, I'll look to you to get us started.
Sure. I want to highlight that the nursing board ultimately has the responsibility to make the final decision about one's fitness for practicing and what the stipulations of that practice will be. And it's clear that the board saw that JC, based on Dr. Hrvancic's evaluation and other information that they had, that he could practice with some probationary terms, because ultimately the board's responsibility is to protect the public and the welfare of consumers. And let me just look at my notes for a second. And the ultimate outcome, based on the psychologist interview, testing, and to go back to the original question of the boards, that there was information that wasn't disclosed initially, that it appears that behavior continued somewhat in the psychological evaluation based on the respondents, the examinees' testing behavior and interview behavior. So I despite JC's concerns and the outcome that he has to do some things as part of probation, I don't see that Dr. Hrvancic did anything that is outside the standard of care. Those are my initial comments.
Thank you. Dr. Stewart?
I certainly agree with my colleague, Dr. Seidman. Were the errors made? Yes, apparently. Were they grievous errors that cost a license? No. Did the ultimate report say that the applicant, in this case the complainant, was able to practice safely with appropriate safeguards? Yes. The two medications are strikingly similar in pronunciation, but do entirely different things. So I'm not seeing anything that rises to a level of malpractice or you know, anything that's wanton disregard for a client or client's rights. Or ultimately, Dr. Hrvancic does evaluations for the Board of Nursing Examiners. in an effort to assist that board in rendering, as the board is a trier of fact, he provides expert testimony and through this report to assist that board in making decisions that protect the health and welfare of citizens of Arizona. And I'm not seeing any malpractice at all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. And my initial concern looking at this was just the failure to correct the error, but I also understand that everything else in the report indicated the sort of, you know, the delta of the error was pretty small here. Is there any discussion or motion? JC, I'm sorry, we have a procedure to follow here, so this is not the time. Any discussion or motion?
When is the time, sir?
We had the time for you to make a statement, and we had questions that you answered. So thank you for that. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the chair would entertain a motion, I move that the case be dismissed.
I second.
Okay, there is a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. None opposed, the motion carries. Thank you, everybody, for being here, JC, Dr. Harbansik, and Ms. Carvis.
Thank you. Have a nice day, everyone.
Thank you. And JC, if you have any further questions, the board staff can be contacted. Okay, it's 10. Let's take a quick comfort break. We'll be back at 10:05.
The only thing in a jail is you have to go through 5 locked doors to get to the bathroom. So it's not an easy process.
Yeah. So sorry for that, Dr. Stewart. Okay, so we're back in open session, or, you know, after the recess. It's 10:06. And the next one on the agenda is 4D, complaint number 25-19 against Gabrielle Lawrence. And before we have Dr. Seidman provide us an overview, I'll make a motion to go into executive session for legal advice.
Second.
Motion and second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. And then opposed, the motion carries.
Mr. Chair, you're muted.
Yeah. I wanted to get it over with, you know, the mute button issues. 10:12 a.m., we are back in open session, case number 25-19. And Dr. Seidman, will you please provide us an overview of this case?
Mr. Diner.
Dr. Lawrence has been licensed by the Arizona State Board of Psychologist Examiners since 1999. And Dr. Lawrence maintains a private practice in Scottsdale, Arizona. Complainant J.A. and his then wife, K.C., participated in marriage counseling sessions with Dr. Lawrence from December 2019 to March of 2020. And J.A. also met once individually with Dr. Lawrence during this time. K.C. Continued to participate in individual sessions with Dr. Lawrence after J.A. dropped out, and did so until 2022. J.A. and K.C. divorce and custody proceedings began in 2022, and K.C. continued in individual sessions with Dr. Lawrence. J.A. represents that the session notes maintained by Dr. Lawrence, which were subpoenaed during court proceedings in 2022, and they were supplied. J.A. asserts that he did not get an opportunity to review them until the spring of 2023. After J.A. reviewed both the marriage counseling session notes and K.C.'s individual session notes, J.A. contacted board staff in April of 2023 with concerns that Dr. Lawrence violated several APA codes of conduct and ethical principles, including failing to inform J.A. about a diagnosis she made and not offering treatment options to him, violating J.A.'s confidentiality as a former client, given that she continued to treat K.C. and talk about J.A. 3, failing to protect the confidentiality of patient records. 4, failing to carry out duties as a mandated reporter of K.C.'s behavior that allegedly impacted their minor daughter's safety and well-being. JA asserts that they stopped seeing Dr. Lawrence because of, quote, feedback bias and lack of confidentiality. JA had reached out to board staff and informed board staff informed JA of the options that JA had to submit a formal complaint regarding these concerns. And approximately a year and a half later, in July of 2024, JA submitted a complaint against a formal complaint against Dr. Lawrence. In September of 2024, board staff received JA's formal complaint with alleged Dr. Lawrence's actions as stated prior, and with the assertion that these behaviors negatively impacted and contributed to the marriage problems and eventual divorce, and causing significant emotional, financial, and psychological harm to JA. Dr. Lawrence submitted a response in a timely manner, and also in November of 2024, and submitted a revised response in December of 2024. And also submitted a medical record as was requested by board staff. In her response, Dr. Lawrence stated that she realized at the time she should have sought advice, but denied all of those allegations made by JA. And that is clearly indicated in the materials that we received. I do want to make note that the Arizona Revised Statute 32-32-24 specifies a clear 4-year time limit for complaints and states clearly that a health profession regulatory board may not act on any complaint received by the board in which an allegation of unprofessional conduct or any other violation of the chapter that applies to a professional who holds an Arizona license occurred more than 4 years before the complaint is received by the board. The marriage counseling concluded in this complaint in March of 2024, which is more than 4 years after the official complaint filing. However, KC was treated by Dr. Lawrence until 2022, which is less than 4 years. So this board does not have jurisdiction over those issues, cannot deliberate on those issues that were presented more than 4 years ago. And that concludes my summary of this case.
This is Jean Galvin. Dr. Seidman, I believe you stated that the marriage counseling concluded in March of 2024. In fact, it concluded in March of 2020.
Yes, you're correct. Okay. I apologize. Yeah.
Okay.
For the record, March of 2020.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. Okay, so I see JA is present. Thank you for being here. Now would be the time to make a statement.
Yes. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. I'm in my car right now. I dropped off my daughter an hour ago, anticipating that the meeting would conclude at 9:30. But so I do want to say that to quote one of my favorite. Unofficial psychologist Bob Ross, the painter, enjoyed painting that life requires, just like painting, a little bit of darkness in order to accentuate the light. So I do want to say that I'm going to reiterate what I just heard, which was you're out of a statute of limitations within your own jurisdiction, like 4 years. However, I do want to reiterate that Gabrielle Lawrence was using my name in a pejorative way in notes when I wasn't meeting with her in 2021, 2022. So if this board is going to be really firm with a certain statute of limitations, that I have to assume that you not only are going to deny your responsibility in maintaining standards based on some sort of a four-year sets of limitations within your own group, then I have to take this out to the Maricopa County Superior Court in order to access that discovery rule, basically, which is, you know, what do you do when you can't put all the pieces together? You don't have money for a lawyer to consult on these allegations of, you know, you forgot one of the allegations, which was me sitting on the psychotherapy notes of another patient, which I submitted in that report, and that was 2019, I think it was. So that's within the 6-year limit. I think the board should look beyond the 4-year statute of limitations that you have established, and look at the primary res ipsa loquitur negligence. Res ipsa loquitur is the thing speaks for itself, where I'm neurodivergent. I have motor tics. Some of them are complex. And one of the things
no diagnosis of the record.
I want to say that I have a semi-eidetic memory. And so basically me being exposed to the psychotherapy notes of somebody else, like I remember the name. It's something that I've lived with for like multiple years. And this is emotional distress that negligence has caused. Plus, you have to take in consideration the conflict of interest and the dual role, where I think psychologists have to maintain their records, if I'm not mistaken, for 6 years. That's the statute of limitation of the Arizona revised statutes. So I'm within that 6-year period. Plus, my name has been used by Dr. Lawrence in notes when I wasn't meeting with her. I think that's being totally overlooked right now. But I understand this board does not want any sort of negative, let's say, a negative, a vitiated name, a name that is less stringent. And it's because this is a for-profit state, in my opinion, of psychology. I've gotten psychology therapy from Arizona State University, where they're not based on like any sort of like motive, any sort of economic motive. So I would like, if this board is going to dismiss based on this 4-year statute of limitations that this board has established, then I have to go into the court system and assume that I'm going to be placing this board, Arizona Board of Psychologists and Examiners, as responsible for maintaining standards, but also some sort of legal liability for allowing these for-profit cash cow counselors, is what I would call them, telling a patient like me, go somewhere else, go to some other therapist during therapy, marriage counseling therapy. I think that's egregious, the fact that a therapist could say, I don't want to work with you anymore. You're too challenging. I would rather work with your wife. And then I'm going to speak pejoratively or negatively about you. So intentional infliction of emotional distress, I think it's 6 years, if I'm not mistaken. And the discovery rule, I think, you know, a case like this could really put Arizona for profit. Jay,
thank you. I appreciate your statement. And I just stopped you because I thought you were getting back to the points you initially mentioned. Any questions for Jay at this point? Okay. I see Dr. Lawrence, you're here. Thank you for being here. And I believe you're here with your attorney, Mr. Eves. Thank you for being here as well. So your statement, and then we'll have questions.
Good morning, Mr. Dinar and committee members. Pleasure to be in front of you, as always. I am going to just address the jurisdictional issue. I think that that's the order of the day. Clearly, J.A.'s treatment ended in 2020. His complaint wasn't filed until 4 years and 4 months later. I think the clear import of the statute is that this board shall not act or may not act in a complaint that's filed more than 4 years after the conduct in question. So I think that that's pretty cut and dried. I think this committee has a handle on that. I'm sure that my colleague, Ms. Galvin, has counseled you sagely on that. What I would point out also is that I'm not talking much about the facts of the complaint here because of the jurisdictional issue, and I'm trying to be efficient. We can certainly answer questions about that. To the extent this board has any questions or concerns there, we will address those. The one thing I would say is J.A. points to a record that he supposedly sat on of another patient. I would just point out that he never brought that to Dr. Lawrence's attention, and he never gave her a copy of that or handed it back to her. She didn't find out about that until the complaint. She has no idea how that happened. So there are some questions about, I think, the legitimacy of this complaint. Other than that, I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Lawrence. She has she's been a pillar of the psychological community. I think one thing she overlooked in her responses was giving you some background about herself. So she's going to talk a little bit about herself. And then, of course, she's open to any questions you might have. So thank you.
Thank you. And I'm really impressed with the work that I'm seeing here, and thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk about this case. Just a little bit about my background. I have all my degrees from Columbia University in New York, and it's interesting that this should be happening because I have been a member with AAMFT for 39 years, and I am a specialist in working with couples and also parents and children. I actually had another, it's kind of interesting. I published an article in 2000, which was in the Journal of Counseling and Development, entitled Ethical Issues Involving When Counseling Minors in a Non-School Setting. And that's been used in universities all over the country, I was told, in training for counselors. So I've had a lot of experience and probably been to at least 39 ethic presentations. I've also completed 12 units after I found out about this on ethical standards. It's hard to find one on couples, just about couples. But I have done, and I will continue to do more to inform myself because here I have all this background in working with couples, and I absolutely had no idea, and it was a mistake on my part to not make official charting for the continuation of the working with the wife. And I understand that now. I've talked to friends and they've also told me, you know, I did that too. And so I felt that I was continuing the kind of the marital therapy or helping KC to be able to work, to make the marriage work. And so I kind of considered it a continuation of the marital therapy, but it wasn't. It was, and I should have stopped then, and I should have consulted with someone. I didn't do that, and I didn't realize that I was not in compliance. So I have learned a lesson, and you know, I think we learn everything from our mistakes, and I certainly have made mistakes in my life. This was one I would have wished not to make. But in the time since then, I've been doing lots to try to catch up and get the kind of training that I need. I'm a registered play therapist. I'm specializing in EMDR, somatic experience, trauma-informed therapy, grief and loss. I started a program called the New Song Center for Grieving Children and Their Families, which is now under the care of Hospice of the Valley. 17 years ago, Dr. Chris Leibowitz and I created the Children's Services Network, which is still growing strong. We do education for in all kinds of areas for mental health people or school people, anyone who's working with a child in mental health. And we've been doing that for 17 years. So I'm a specialist in trauma and attachment and bonding. And let's see, I've been on the boards of hospice. I've been on the boards of the diocese as the expert mental health person, the Safe Environment Board. I was on that for 6 years. I was on the board with hospice for 6 years. So, you know, I would have thought that I would have more, more awareness of this. But at the time, I honestly didn't. I'm not trying to plead innocent, but at that point, I just did not realize that I was violating something that should have been taken care of, and I should have consulted. And so again, I believe in my report and the response to the complaint that I have adequately met or described what needed to happen, or I'm nervous now, so please excuse me, All of those complaints, I don't know if you want me to go into that. You probably don't.
But... No, probably not, because we first need to sort of like decide the threshold issue of what to do with the statute of limitations. But I appreciate your statement, Doctor. And let's see if the board members...
May I establish ethos for 1 minute? Is that possible?
I'm sorry, Jay.
59 seconds?
No, okay. we understand the situation. I appreciate you interjecting. Committee members, any questions for Dr. Lawrence at this time? Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. Good morning, Dr. Lawrence. I appreciate your sharing with us your longstanding, illustrious, and impressive career. Thank you for that. And your longstanding AAMFT membership and all the great work that you've done. And I'm curious that you weren't aware of that idea. Once you were aware that JA had stopped coming to the marital counseling and it became clear that it was individual counseling for JA's spouse, I'm curious why at that point you didn't realize, wait a second, I need to do something different. And the second question is, what was the obstacle for you to consult with somebody?
I think you're on mute. You're muted.
That was my fault. Sorry.
Thank you. I will try to answer that. First of all, I didn't realize, I thought I was still doing, helping with the marital situation. And there was something else I wanted to say with that. And didn't realize the need to actually stop and create a new chart. And that was... I actually thought that J.A. would be coming back into therapy and was hoping he would. And I had an individual session with him because he was having a very difficult time in the therapy. And I wanted to talk to him about the possibility of getting into his own individual therapy, because I think he needed that, and that would be helpful for the marital work. And that's very normal. There are many people who are doing marital therapy, and both of them are in individual work, and it was very successful for him. He clearly reported that it was wonderful for him to do the work with the therapist at ASU, and I was delighted about that. I knew that he had problems, and I was trying to accommodate them and make it easier for him. And so I was hoping he would come back. So I really was really stupid. I should have known that it was, well, when he didn't come back, and he didn't come back and didn't come back, then I should have consulted somebody. I thought I was doing the right thing. I have to be honest. And it was stupid. I've had all that training, and, you know, I can't believe that happened. But so that now will never happen again.
And so he asked you about the obstacle. Was the obstacle just your ignorance of that you were doing anything wrong?
Yeah, that is exactly. I mean, I have to say, really, my intent was quite innocent. I wasn't. I just thought I was doing something that was helpful, and it was helpful for the wife. It actually helped them in their relationship, and her work with me really just showed that very clearly. It helped the daughter who had been hitting herself, and that stopped, and I helped them be able to communicate better. So I thought, well, heck, you know, this is what I'm supposed to help people.
Yeah, Dr. Lawrence, I don't doubt your intentions. I know you had all the best of intentions. I don't doubt that at all. I'm curious of once you realized this wasn't a case, it was getting more complicated, obviously, and he wasn't coming back, and you were treating the wife. What was the obstacle for you to seek help? You've been in the community for a long time. I know you have a lot of connections, and I'm just curious, what was the obstacle for you to seek help, as that's our ethical mandate, is to consult when we're...
I have to say it was my own stupidity. I didn't realize that I was doing something wrong. I mean, I know that sounds crazy after all the training that I've had, but I really did not realize it. And it was only when Jennifer Michelson said, you know, we are really interested in why you didn't cut it off and, excuse me, do a new chart. And I went, oh, I should have done that? Okay. I just honestly didn't realize I was doing the wrong thing. And so I didn't think about consulting anyone. And that's, I know that sounds ridiculous, but I thought helping them in their marital relationship, even though I wasn't seeing him, I knew he was being taken care of by another therapist, and I was happy about that. But the only obstacle was my real failure to realize that I was doing the wrong thing and that I should have stopped. I should have said, that's it, and created a new chart for his wife. And we would have gone from there.
Even the transition, though, from the marital therapy to the individual therapy was outside of the 4-year window as well. I just wanted to point that out.
Yes, yes. I just need to ask a follow-up question.
Sure.
Dr. Lawrence, do you have a consulting network of colleagues that you can go to?
Oh, yes. And you know most of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a feeling you were going to say that. And I'm just curious, why in this particular case you didn't go. That and you already answered it, I think. I just want to, you know, plant that seed. So,
well, I do realize that. And I will tell you that it's made me much, much more aware of what I do and how I do it. And, working on this case and having to defend myself and all that has really been, in a way, a godsend, because I've learned more by having to go back and really investigate, you know, and think about the therapy that I am doing and be very vigilant in terms of anything that might be something that I'm not realizing, but it needs to be inspected. And if I had that realization, I would, of course, immediately done what needed to be done and ended the marital and gone right into a new chart with the wife. And I don't have much of a defense, but now I will never do that again. So that is, you know, and it's interesting because I've been to lots of ethics things, you know, ethic presentations, and I've done a lot of work with couples. I'm a family marriage and family therapist, but nobody has ever mentioned that. Isn't that interesting? And I had a hard time finding anything. In fact, I never found anything. And I took several courses, you know, several presentations on ethics and relationships, and there was nothing in that on the marital therapy and how you deal with it. So that would, I had no idea I was doing the wrong thing. I just thought helping, and I felt good about helping. So,
of course, yeah. So, what have you put into place that will help you next time?
Well, this situation that I've just been in, you know, that is, as I said, it has really been a time of really taking a look at and being more conscious of things that could possibly be violations. I try very hard to not violate anything, but it has made me more aware, and it's helped me to reach out, and so in that way, it's been helpful for me. But it hasn't been an easy year. having a board complaint is never something one really wants to do. But anyway, I hope I've answered your question. And I guess the answer is I was just not conscious of what I was doing enough to, not aware that it was a problem. And as I said a minute ago, I have talked to several other friends of mine since then, and they said, you know, and I'm of course not going to give names, I think I did the same thing, you know? And so I think it's something that needs to be addressed more clearly in ethics presentations, especially when you're dealing with relationships. I took one with the first one I took was one ethics in relationship to relationships. And, but that had nothing about couples.
And it didn't mention anything about the need for changing the chart from marital therapy to individual therapy.
No, I had no idea that I was really doing the wrong thing. I just thought it was helpful. And it was helping her with her marriage. So, you know, sometimes it doesn't connect.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Dr. Lawrence? Okay, then let's go into our discussion portion, I again call on Dr. Seidman to get us started.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. I think the committee is restricted by the 4-year limitation, as delineated in the Arizona Revised Statute. I'm a little perplexed. Dr. Lawrence has been a pillar in our community for a long time and has great training and has been doing some really terrific work over the many, many years she's been practicing. And it just, I'm perplexed about I shouldn't say that. Let me rephrase that. I appreciate her desire to help people. And I do believe that she was doing things in the best interest of her clients. I would state that consultation is a really terrific way to check ourselves and to make sure we're looking out for the welfare of our clients in the best possible way. I don't think that Dr. Lawrence has violated any of the requirements of our profession. And I think she met the standard of care, and with the caveat of the consultation and legible records. So I'll stop there.
I agree with you, Dr. Seidman. And in my mind, I think it's a complicated issue when there is sort of like a continuation of sort of, you know, seeing somebody over a course of many years. I mean, we can't sort of have like a clear line of demarcation all the time where, okay, you know, these records relate to this and these records relate to this issue. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, I'm a lawyer, but many times when you have a client, you know, as a lawyer for many, many years, it's hard to sort of like cleave the case file, you know, in a certain way. So I do appreciate that, you know, I do appreciate the concerns there, but I don't think that Dr. Lawrence, it's like, you know, what could she have done? What, you know, that may have avoided this, and I can't think of anything. So Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that Dr. Lawrence was coming from a place of generally seeking to help her clients in their marital situation. That line of demarcation, stopping marriage counseling and then a new beginning to look at individual counseling is complicated, because you still have the same person there in front of you that was there as one half of the marital contingent. Mm-hmm. So I can certainly see that, excuse me, there'd be references back to other times and looking at notes. I think it's, you know, the formal complaint was more than 4 years ago in terms of some of the issues. The marital counseling stopped, and then KC continued counseling with Dr. Lawrence. But I'm just not seeing anything that rises to a level of professional misconduct. I think the worst case scenario is a clerical procedural issue that ultimately the psychologist, Dr. Lawrence, has responsibility for, but doesn't seem to be related to treatment or the welfare of her client. So I'm if the chair will entertain a motion, certainly.
Sure.
I move that the case be dismissed.
Second.
There's a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 None opposed, the motion carries.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Okay, so the last case on today's agenda is complaint number 25-13 against Marilyn Good. And Dr. Stewart, will you please provide us an overview? Before you do that, just a heads up, I have a cutoff at 11 a.m., but the committee will have quorum of Dr. Stewart and Dr. Seidman. So Dr. Stewart, the floor is yours. You're muted.
Thank you. Marilyn Good is a PsyD. Got her doctorate from JFK University in 2013. She has been licensed here in Arizona since 2018. Her license expires in June of 2026. The specific complaint has to do with record keeping. And the action was opened and a databank report was made by the military. Dr. Good was a private contracted employee working in military service area. The National Data Bank, again, primarily is one of record keeping. I'm not finding anything of substance there that I can sink my teeth into. Dr. Good's response is, now she's not represented by an attorney. He has been an active duty service member in the military for many years prior to transitioning into being a psychologist and working on military bases. Dr. Good is restricted from discussing many areas and cannot respond to them because it would be a HIPAA compliance, because she's not actively involved in some of those cases anymore. And that's about the best I can do at this point. The case and the issues involved are record keeping, as far as I can see, and there's been a data bank referral in which Dr. Good finds herself. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Dr. Good, I see you. Thank you for being here. I don't see the... This is a board complaint, so there's no complainant. So Dr. Good, now would be the time to make a statement.
Sure. So I have worked as an active duty military with the Army for 10 years and then decided to switch to civilian. I contracted with Sterling Medical. and then was assigned to Spangdahlem Air Base in Germany as a PCBH provider. So that this role is a consultant to medical providers in regards to their patients. So, like I said, I've been in this position for 5 years. At first, it was challenging because we had a template specific for PCBH. And in that template, it was not flexible for us to write, specify clearly about patients' information. So we had to click a different buttons to reflect patients' answers. So what I like to do is I like to write. So as the patient writes, what I did was, so they come in. So basically the meeting is no more than 30 minutes. The patient comes in and reports, for example, symptoms such as depression, anxiety, and everything. And when it comes to the assessing risk and asking about suicidal ideations and things like that, the patient reports, well, I have thought about it. But then again, I specify, is it morbid ideations or are those passive ideas? So I am pretty specific. Unfortunately, that template didn't let me be specific. It requires us to give a screener, the CSSRS, which is the Columbia Suicide Severity Scale. So in that, whenever the patient answers that, so they do report that they've been feeling suicidal. But when I ask them later on, it ends up being very passive or morbid with no intent to act. I guess what happens is that a provider, when they reviewed my note, they saw a discrepancy between the screening tool and my writing of exactly how the patient feels. And I guess I failed to write a blurb stating that discrepancy. And sometimes with time, it's very rushed. And so I didn't get the chance to do that. Later on, there was a meeting about it and I was asked to make corrections. And I consulted with a peer who was enlisted to review my notes. And I did make those corrections. Whenever I handed out a screener to the patient reporting anything that has to do with suicidal ideations, I put their own words in quotes and I just write it in detail. So I was able to fix this after that. So there was just a discrepancy between the tools that were used by patients in reporting how they feel and my own assessment. So it felt discrepant.
Thank you. Questions for, yes, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Good, now you indicated that you have fixed the reported problematic note keeping on your own. And yes, after the meeting that you had with the superiors and the review, a peer mm-hmm. review of your notes,
yes,
that you've corrected that. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. After January, we switched again templates. So a whole new system came up, and we had to adjust to that. But I honestly, after that experience, I just created my own in a Word document where I copied and pasted everything in that new system that's called Genesis.
Was there ever any complaint about patient care against you? You ever been accused of, in this process, in this complaint, have there been any complaints about patient care, patient mistreatment, or has it all been about documentation?
There was an investigation that was made after that. I requested an investigation. So, and it was found, there was a discrepancy with record keeping and time, notes not being put on time. But other than that, anything that
you've answered, you've answered my question. Thank you so much. That's all of my questions, Mr. Diner.
Thank you. Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. Good morning, Dr. Good.
Good morning, sir.
Just a quick question. Have you ever failed to protect a client that was a danger to themselves?
I never did. Okay. Never did. Because to be honest with you, in PCBH services, it's consulting to the doctors. So anyone that is suicidal, I'm not allowed to treat them. It was not providing psychotherapy. It was an assessment, a screen. So it's like a lower level care. Anyone that needs higher level care needs to go to mental health, escorted to mental health.
Let me state thank you. Let me state my question a different way. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Have you ever failed to assess a person that was a danger to themselves?
Never.
Thank you.
Never.
All right. Any more questions for Dr. Good?
I have a motion if the chair would entertain it.
Sure.
I move that the case against Dr. Good, the complaint, be dismissed.
Second.
So motion and a second. And as a matter of discussion, I agree. I mean, there is nothing here. I mean, I know there is a National Practitioners Data Bank report on this, but I'm satisfied given the responses heard today that, you know, this wasn't, it doesn't really fit into any of our definitions of unprofessional conduct, the record keeping issue. So, okay, there's a motion on the table. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. None opposed, the motion carries. Thank you, Dr. Guren. I appreciate you attending from Germany.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Have a good night. Thank you.
All right, then it is 10:56, and I'll exercise my privilege to adjourn the meeting. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.